Digital 410 Productions proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts Don Abernathy and Jeff Copsetta.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man to man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast. I know we're 3 days late on that, but hey, we didn't have a show until tonight, so why not celebrate a little bit with, you know, the invasion speech, or letter, I guess, if you will, that was written to the infantry soldiers prior to the landings and execution of Operation Overlord on June 6, 1944. Joining us again tonight, I think he's slowly taking the lead in the most reoccurring appearances on the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast. He is the historian, author, and all-around great guy, Jared Frederick. Jared, how are you doing tonight, friend?
I am very well. Thank you for having me, and I'm glad to be back on the podcast.
I'm glad to have you back. We got some very exciting things to talk about tonight, but before we get to that, I was just going over your Facebook page again, and I saw that you guys just recently had a little more TV coverage, and you were very thrilled to participate along with your friends over at the Furious Fourth World War II Living History Association. You guys got to do a little D-Day celebration, if you will, over on C-SPAN. How did that go? How did that come about?
That was actually from 2 years ago, from the 75th anniversary. But it has re-aired a number of times on C-SPAN, and it's made its rounds on social media, and you know, that was just one of those happenstance sort of living history events where you know, you have your encampment set up and you're told by the event organizers, hey, C-SPAN's here and they would like to talk to somebody in the group. And inevitably when that happens, all my buddies point to me because I'm one of the designated talkers often.
Well, those occurrences can go one of two ways. If you have a spokesperson for your group that has the media presence and the experience like you do, it goes swimmingly well. And as you said, the coverage gets replayed on C-SPAN a few times, and it continues to help all those around. Or you get somebody who doesn't want to do it, but he's kind of pushed out in front of the crowd. They fumble through an interview. It's embarrassing for everybody to watch, and it's never seen again except for maybe on the promo reel of the local news person who's trying to get to a better market. But I'm happy to see that yours went swimmingly well.
Thank you.
So you got some exciting news, and just for the uninitiated or the new followers to the podcast, Jared is not only a living historian, he is an author. His fifth book just came out. He has Altoon, Dispatches of D-Day, Gettysburg's National Military Parks, Entertaining History, the Civil Wars, and Literature, Film, and Song. And most recently, which my copy will show up on the 10th, is Hanging Tough, the World War II Letters and Artifacts of Major Dick Winters. How did this come to play, and how did you get access to some of these artifacts?
Well, the project is really rooted in my friend and co-author, Eric Dorr. who is the owner and curator of the Gettysburg Museum of History in Pennsylvania. And quite naturally, it's one's instinct to think of the American Civil War when you hear Gettysburg.
Sure.
But Gettysburg also has a very rich World War II history as well. There is a national cemetery there that has well over 1,600 GIs buried in it, many of whom were killed in the war. Many people don't know that Gettysburg is also the American sister city of St. Mary Glees in Normandy.
I wasn't aware of that either.
It is. Yeah, the two towns have a relationship. These pivotal battles took place in their respective towns. And of course, it was the post-war home of Dwight Eisenhower. But a lot of people don't realize also that Dick Winters lived in the Gettysburg area immediately following the Second World War as he was starting a family.
Yeah, we know so famously he kind of made a promise to God that if he were to make it through this insanity, that he would find a nice, quiet piece of land and settle down. And apparently to him, Gettysburg was as quiet as it comes, and not to mention it's beautiful and the history side. I knew he went to Pennsylvania, but I didn't know it was Gettysburg that he settled down in.
For a short time. And then eventually he moved into the Hershey area, and he had a home in Hershey proper, and he also had a farm outside of town. But true to form, and as you see in the miniseries, and as I found out as I was researching this book, that he was writing to his parents as the war was ongoing, asking them to look for pieces of property that he might be able to settle on in the years after the war. But the project is really rooted in the collection and the passion of my co-author, Eric Dorr. And about 5 years ago now, he had the opportunity to purchase various components of Dick Winters' artifacts.
Did he have a close family connection or tie, or was it just through common acquaintances and historical associations?
Common acquaintances. Eric had become friends with a number of people who were close to the major. And the short of the story is that Eric sought to consolidate this collection, and he wanted to provide a home for it in which it could be shown to the public and accessible to the public. And over the years since, his collection has really grown, and it's really, I think, the finest assortment of Easy Company memorabilia and artifacts to be found in the United States, perhaps even the world. And you know, he has not only Winters items, but you know, he has things belonging to Forrest Guth.
Wow.
You know, and some of the best known members of that very vaunted unit. And so in many ways, Dick Winters is just the tip of the iceberg.
When it came to organizing, laying out the book and cataloging some of these collections or some of these letters, is there a particular item or maybe a factoid, if you will, from one of the letters that came across that you know, you're surprised by, super unfamiliar with, things like that?
Constantly. I was constantly surprised by things that we were finding. And I think one of the real merits of the book is that it shows how Winters evolved as an individual and as a leader. The letters start in 1941. He was in the peacetime army, and he opted to, you know, get his year of, you know, service done rather than be drafted. He wanted to get his 1 year of service done and over with, and he didn't want his life to be interrupted later on if he were to be conscripted. And so he starts then, and, you know, he starts out as this very positive thinking and very driven, self-assured young man. And his confidence never really wavered, as best as I could tell. But over time, as the war goes on, he did become more cynical. And his letters often grew darker.
Mm-hmm.
He had a more pessimistic view of the world and sometimes the army.
I could see that. I mean, as time goes by and seeing the things and experiencing the things that he's seen, not only that, but to deal with the loss of not only men that you're in charge of, but as we all know, famously, Easy Company being one of the very first organization of men to not only fight together, but to train together, go through all that, and then fight together. I'm not saying it takes anything less away from a leader who loses men that they don't have that experience with, but let's be honest, to go from a group of guys that you were in boot camp with, that you slowly earned your way into a leadership role, and then lose the guys that you spent the last 3 years with, if you don't compartmentalize and be a little cynical about it, it'll be completely devastating, and it would be next to impossible to do your mission in the way in which is required of someone in that position, in that caliber of war.
Yeah, absolutely. And he writes about factors such as this, where, you know, he really underscores the importance of officers staying arm's length from their subordinates. And he essentially makes the argument to his pen pal that, you know, I can't get too attached to them because I may have to send them off to die. And he could not, in his mind, fully emotionally process doing something like that. But inevitably, he did grow attached and accustomed to these men. And when they did perish, he lost a little bit of his soul in the process. But he tried to keep that arm's length, but he did not always succeed.
So you're saying his confidence never waned. So in your research and in your mind, you know, he kind of was born leader. I mean, to join up early, like you said, because he didn't want to risk, you know, getting drafted and then not having a choice, as we heard a lot of the good and then not having a choice, as we heard a lot of the guys who signed up for Airborne, they wanted to be around the best because they wanted the guy fighting in the foxhole with them, the men fighting along with them, to be the best, to improve their survival rating. But it seems like he was just kind of a natural born leader and just fell into the role quite well early on.
And that was really instilled in him at a very young age. His mother came from old Mennonite stock in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And he learned how to be self-dependent. He learned how to be a hard worker. He was a very intellectually driven individual.
Yeah.
You know, not many people in 1941 had a college education. That didn't come about till after the war. But he graduated from college, from Franklin and Marshall College in 1941. And, you know, he had, you know, all of these internal mechanisms that allowed him to process and working his way up the officer chain. The other really interesting thing about him, though, that emerges in these letters is the fact that he thought himself to be a very shy individual. You know, he likened himself to a still wallflower. You know, he was always the kid who was sitting in the back of the classroom who never raised his hand. And so, you know, it's, you know, this tough as nails individual, you know, you don't think of such individuals like that being shy or reserved. But I think it went back to kind of that meekness, that humility that was tied in with his ancestry and his upbringing in rural Pennsylvania that made him that way.
Real quick, for those of you watching on YouTube and on Facebook, our co-host Jeff Copsetta just snuck into the interview. Hey, Jeff, how you doing, sir?
Hey, man, I guess I didn't get the memo for what time we were rolling tonight.
No worries. We're here with Jared Frederick. We're talking about his new book that he partnered up with on. It's the book Hang Tough, the World War II Letters and Artifacts of Major Dick Winters. And we were just talking about how Dick Winters kind of, you know, grew into being a natural born leader. And Jared was referring to his Mennonite background, which makes complete sense. And for those of you at home who aren't quite sure the difference between a Mennonite and someone from the Amish community, basically Mennonites believe in electricity and modern technology, and they utilize it. But once again, we're talking modern technology on a 1935, 1940 scale. And so for someone, you know, easily his religion had a great impact because, one, as Jared was saying, but growing up in basically in a community that relies on manual labor and community and honor and fulfilling your obligation and pulling your weight, to grow up in that environment where your, you know, responsibility and commitment is entrusted in you early, that had to have tremendous impact and help him gain to the level that he did quicker than, you know, people even compared to contemporaries in that echelon of airborne, you know, growing up in that work environment compared to, you know, a Babe Heffron or someone who still was elite, but from the city who didn't have that same background. I'm sure that religion and just that childhood had tremendous effect on how he was able to strive and succeed as well as he did.
And go ahead,
Jared. Sorry about that. I just want to hop in. I'm sorry. I missed some of this. No worries. Some of this tonight. But if I could just hop in real quick, we talk about that a lot. And Jared, you may agree, whether the religious background or where you're from, like you mentioned, you know, rural Pennsylvania, you know, everything kind of shapes who we are and who you become as a leader in the military, leader in the civilian world. But I truly believe, and I'd like to hear your opinion on this, that's what made the Greatest Generation so great, was because that what they had to endure during the war, they were able to do it, or most of them were able to do it because of their childhood, because of the amount of responsibility, because of what it took to survive in the late 20s and 30s.
Great those Depression. Responsibilities.
Right. The Great Depression, dust, all those things that just, it kind of was like they were, well, I mean, I guess they said it best. They had a rendezvous with destiny, and I think a lot of it came from their childhood, their upbringing, what they had to do, which was day-to-day stuff. So when they get over there and they hit the beach, that kind of stuff was commonplace. What do you think?
Yeah, definitely so. And a phrase comes to mind that the late, great Louis Zamperini coined. And he was never really a huge fan of the phrase "the greatest generation." The phrase that he preferred was "the hardiest generation."
Absolutely,
and I think that is just a perfect quotation that sums it up. And you know, to your point, Jeff, I think many people fit under that category. These guys grew up poor. But as so many of them have told me, they didn't know they were poor in the 1930s because everybody else was living the same existence that they were. And so without television and social media, they didn't have that sort of context or alternative worldview. But as for Winters, I think that was definitely the case to an extent. He and his family were a little bit better off than most in the Depression. His father worked for Edison Electric, and that's where Dick got one of his first jobs, and that was actually climbing up high and painting utility poles. And as he often said or joked later on, that's kind of where he became familiar with heights. And perhaps, that's where he was able to overcome his fear of heights. Leading into his entry into the paratroops later on. I think that's spot on.
And kind of to add on to what Jeff said, I just did a quick search and I found the census for the 1930s, actually 1920s. And so we can extrapolate a little bit going into late 1937. But in 1920, according to the census, 30.2% of the United States population were farmers. And I think that had a great deal to do, not only with airborne, but just regular service personnel across the board. When you have a group of people, 30% of them, working that farm lifestyle where you're getting up at 5 in the morning and you're working until the sun goes down, when you've been doing that for 17, 18 years, you know, humping through the field all day carrying heavy gear, not counting, you know, dealing with death and getting shot at, but just the physical requirements of that was probably, I don't want to say easier, but they're more adept to it back then than our population would be now, with probably our population being like 0.5% farmers. And so that upbringing and that hardiness that Jeff was referring to definitely had a huge impact on how hardy that stock was and how they're able to survive living in those conditions for so long.
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned the hardiest generation, because I've had the same thing from I don't know how many. I've never spoke to a World War II vet that considered himself part of the greatest generation. I've had a few of them say the greatest generation were my parents. And you really think about how the parents of what we call the greatest generation, what they had to go through, you know, maybe even more so than the youngsters who became our greatest generation, you know, that turn of the century and even into the late 1800s, how much tougher life was before things like electricity and, you know, combustion engines. So I find that fascinating, you know, the greatest generation's parents. So who thinks about them so much, you know?
Yeah, and I suspect Dick Winters himself may have agreed with you to a large extent, because in his letters, he wrote fairly often about his mother. He was incredibly close with his mother. He thanked her for a lot of the smarts and sensibilities that he had in his life. And so I have no doubt that he would probably have shared those sentiments.
You know, going real quick back to the phrase greatest generation, one of the things that it still sticks in the back of my head when I hear that term, obviously my father's parents were part of that generation. And the very first time I read, it was either the Band of Brothers or one of the maybe We Are Alive, one of the following books. I'm looking right now, The Brothers in Battle, The Best of Friends, or one of the other following books. But they were talking, I don't think it was Shifty Powers, it was another one, that he made it back home, got back to port, and he was hitchhiking his way back home. And as he was hitchhiking, the driver said, "Hey, I got to urinate," and they pulled off on the side of the road, the country road, and I hate the fact that he's the member of Easy Company slips my mind, but anyhow, he gets out to urinate as well, and the guy driving the car robs him, pulls a gun in the back, takes all his money, all his back pay, all his bring home stuff, basically just stole his old duffel bag. And I was explaining to my dad that this guy just survived, you know, all the years in boot camp, all these years in the war, seeing his friends die, just to get robbed at gunpoint in the back on the side of the country road. My dad said, "So much for the greatest generation, huh?" And that always sticks in my head that, yes, even with the greatest generation, there was a percentage of them that were just dirtbags looking to take advantage of people at any shake. But
no generation is perfect.
Exactly. So you were referring earlier to Dick Winters writing to his pen pal. Was there one particular person that he wrote to frequently that we know of by name? And who was this person?
Indeed. Her name was Dieta Alman, and she was a Navy wave. And she is an individual who's very important in Dick Winters' World War II years. She gets no reference at all in the series, and I don't think at all in Stephen Ambrose's book. But she was a very important figure in Dick Winters' life. And they met essentially on a blind date when he was stationed in Camp Croft immediately prior to Pearl Harbor. He was in Camp Croft, South Carolina. She lived in Asheville, North Carolina. They're right over the border essentially from one another. And they started a written correspondence prior to Pearl Harbor. In fact, Dick was horseback riding with her when Pearl Harbor was bombed, and wow, they rode back into town, and that's what they heard on the radio. And over the next 4 years, she And well, he wrote her over 100 letters. And those are the basis for the narrative in our book. And what we do is that Eric and I, my co-author, we present the letters in an unfiltered way, and then we stitch them together with our context, commentary, and observations to offer a cohesive timeline for the readers throughout. And, you know, it's really compelling stuff because, you know, when you read Band of Brothers, you watch the series, what you see in that is how Dick Winters' men saw him. It's not how Dick Winters saw himself. And through these letters, we see how Dick Winters was thinking in the moment. And that's a really valuable thing as far as historical documentation goes, because, you know, a lot of these guys in Easy Company, of course, you know, they wrote memoirs 55, 65 years after the fact. The fog of war has settled in a little bit. And that's certainly not the case with these letters. They have a sense of immediacy to them. They are written in the moment. They are not written with hindsight. Victory was not a foregone conclusion as Dick was writing these letters. And so it offers a very in-the-moment perspective that I think is just really refreshing.
Well, it's funny that you just used the word refreshing, because I was sitting here waiting to follow it up, and the word that I had in my mind was refreshing, as in it's got to be refreshing not only for you as an author, but I mean, let's face it, out of everybody I know in the living history community, you do more research and spend more time thumbing through materials than anybody I know. But for the reader's aspect, I mean, as you said, there's so many books written on the topic of the Band of Brothers, and we're always kind of rereading the same stories depending on whose book it is. But now you're getting a refreshing aspect that we haven't seen before of Dick Winters, not only in his own words, but through the transcript of writing back and forth with his pen pal. And the other thing I was thinking about when you're talking about the fact that she was a member of Waves, you know, in a lot of movies and stories, you know, they write back to their sweetheart who maybe is working in a factory or doing something on the home front. But I think there's probably something important, or even maybe an aspect of having someone that you're writing to who's in the member of the service at the time, even though it's not the exact same service that he's doing. But there's probably something about that allows him to open up a little bit more than maybe if you're writing to someone who's getting up and going to a factory every day or going into a school and teaching every day, because that person understands some of the minutiae of the hierarchy of the military and the daily life of being in service. And so that's something that he could probably relate without actually having to write it, because she knows what he's going through as far as the of being in the service. And so that had to be helpful too, you would think.
Absolutely. And I think your point of him relating to someone else in the military is an important one. All that said, though, he certainly did not see the Waves as being on the same level as the airborne. And he, at times, he was comedically dismissive.
Oh, really?
Of the Waves. And he, in short, and he was very clear about this in his letters. He did not think too much of service members if they were not paratroopers or if they were not Marines. there's some really funny lines that he says about, like, the service of supply guys, and, you know, like these hash slingers, and he's like, they don't know what this is all about. Like, they're just wearing uniforms. Like, they aren't real soldiers. Just some kind of funny off the wall humor like that.
Well, I'm sure Jeff can relate to some of that, because he is, in fact, a retired military personnel, and he probably. I would imagine that when you're on the front lines and as they say, when that supply gets to you, a lot of it's already been picked through. I'm sure that creates a whole sense of thought about the guys in the rear of the gear, huh, Jeff?
Yeah, no surprise what Jared said. I mean, when you become – so I was in Army Recon, and, you know, you feel like you're just a little bit better than everybody else. You've got that chip on your shoulder. And I remember having a real, you know, downward outlook on the rest of the – just those regular Joes in the Army and especially the National Guard and Reserves. But I will tell you, I think a difference I share – or something I don't share with Dick Winters is I did see my outlook completely change about halfway through my tour when I saw the Arkansas National Guard boys that were attached to my brigade completely getting blooded every single day. I didn't look at them as National Guard pukes anymore. They were doing the same job as me. They had the same mission, except they had poor equipment, you know, less armor or no armor, less, you know, crappier vehicles. And I would sneak over to their chow hall every now and then and hang out with these guys. And they're talking about how their wife had to foreclose on their house because the job that they were guaranteed to get back to had already let go of them. So I don't want to get too far off topic, but no surprise at all that Dick Winters would be there. I had a feeling he would probably like, yeah, wait, you know what I'm talking about, right? Yeah, no.
His perspectives definitely mellowed with age. And I think as the totality of the war and its history kind of sunk in his mind, I think he undoubtedly took the same attitude that you just addressed.
Sure.
But you know, in his letters to Dieta, she really, in many ways, served as this emotional ballast as he was going through all this stuff. And in essence, you know, he told her, he says, you know, I can tell you things and I can write things to you that I can't write to my mother. And you know, from a psychological perspective, it's so important to have somebody like that when you're going through difficult times. You know, a number of my students are veterans. A number of my former students are still in the military, and you know, a number of them have called me, you know, when times are tough, and you know, they've told me, you know, I can't tell my mother this. So you know, having somebody to listen to, and in this case to write back, is, you know, we shouldn't, you know, overlook that too much. But you know, it's just such a fascinating dynamic. And it's a whole other side of Dick Winters that I think most people haven't taken into consideration.
Yeah, I'm extremely excited and looking forward for June 10th to roll around when Amazon's going to deliver that bad boy into my mailbox, and I'm going to promptly read it. I was just having this thought when we were talking about writing letters and how it's so beneficial to, I don't want to say offload that, but I just had this weird premonition, and I may even be wrong on this, and so we're going to leave World War II briefly. In the movie Platoon, part of the narration, Charlie Sheen's talking to his grandmother about the letters he's writing, correct? Kind of doing that same thing where he's getting what he's experiencing out of his mind, you know, out, so he's not carrying it. For some reason, and I may be wrong about this, which makes, and if I am wrong, it's going to blow this whole theory up. But what's crazy about in that movie and him constantly narrating these letters to his grandma, correct me if I'm wrong, but at the end of the movie, we find out that she doesn't exist, or he didn't have a grandma. And basically he was just doing that in his head to offload these feelings and this compassion that he was having, wanting to get all this stuff off of his mind so he's not carrying that burden. Was I wrong on that?
I'm not sure.
But
I'm not aware of that.
For some reason, I could be.
He references his mom to his grandma.
Yeah, but I just thought there was a point. But anyhow, even still, just like in that movie in Vietnam, he's just getting it out there. And so, yeah, it's got to be tremendous help to be able to offload that, and, you know, to someone who can deal with it and, you know, not completely destroy him like it would your mom. Because your mom's already worried about you coming back. And coming back in one piece, but then to have to be burdened with the psychological stuff that you're going through just would make it that much harder for them to deal with and to cope on a daily basis, especially considering back then we don't have the benefits of a Zoom, instant message, and email. You're writing a letter and waiting weeks, if not months, to hear back, even with the streamlined email system we have, which still blows my mind. And that just goes to show you back how important morale was back then. that we would take an X amount of planes, ships, whatever, and set aside X amount of space for nothing but letters to get it over there as quick as possible to help keep the guys going. But even still, it's still weeks, if not months, to get those letters out to you.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, something interesting about the timing in that regard, in relation to Dick's letters, it's often very revealing when there's gaps in his correspondence. You know, there's a gap between mid-December and the beginning of February, 1944-1945. And, you know, that certainly indicates that during the Battle of the Bulge, he did not have time to be writing letters as such. But, you know, luckily, Winters, something else that people don't take into consideration is what an incredible historian he was.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was so thorough in his documentation and records, both during and after the war. This was a veteran who had a file on every one of his men, as many as he could make possible. And he had file cabinets in his home office in Hershey. And he would write to these men, and he would photocopy their responses, and he would collect their photographs. And this is ultimately why this treasure trove of firsthand accounts and connections that Winters had is how and why Stephen Ambrose chooses to write a book on these guys, is because all the information and all the testimony was consolidated thanks to Dick Winters. If it was not for Dick Winters, that would have been an impossible book to write, hunting all those guys down, finding their addresses in the days before the internet.
And that, and the fact that
Winters had it all.
Yeah, I was going to say that, and the fact that they consistently had their anniversaries, that there was something to go to track them down as well, too. Mm-hmm. And so is that some of the material which your co-author Eric got a hold of? Is some of those files and some of that content?
Mm-hmm. Yes. He has a huge assortment of Winters files, as well as documents of other Easy Company men as well, ranging from photographs, unit albums, correspondence, the works. And that was really one of the things that drew me into the project, is because, you know, Don, like you referenced a moment ago, you know, I was of the mind, what could possibly be new and interesting to write about the Band of Brothers?
Yeah.
I never envisioned myself becoming one of those authors, you know. I thought it was, you know, heavily tread territory.
Well, I mean, you're a living historian, and you've heard the phrase bandwagoner brothers thrown around a handful of time at events.
I didn't want to say it. I was going to let you do it. But once I saw a lot of these documents and letters and copies of letters, you know, I was just of the mind, how can I not do this? I just thought, this is incredible stuff. And it's, you know, been hidden, you know, for the most part for all these years. And so it was just an incredible opportunity. And I wanted to flesh out the story, you know. And in the beginning of our book, you know, I liken Dick Winters to the Civil War general Joshua Chamberlain. You know, not until these men were considerably older for the most part did the world find out who they were. And the world did find out who they were is because they were the main characters in highly successful books that were then turned into highly successful Hollywood productions.
That continued to get played.
Gettysburg and Band of Brothers, respectively. Mm-hmm. And I think in so many ways, those two officers who were in the thick of combat had the peace of mind to write about their experiences. They have become symbolic of their respective generations for both the Civil War and the Second World War. even if a lot of people don't know about those conflicts, there's a strong possibility they've at least heard of those two guys because of how they've been portrayed in movies and whatnot.
And someone who most recently, within the last 8 years, fell into that camp was someone who actively went against policy and down in the Pacific of you're not to write any letters about troop movements, where we've been, because if you get killed and someone loots your body, that intel is going, and that would be Eugene Sledge, because he took the liberty to write what we would call, you know, just little reminders throughout his diary. Not his diary, but his Bible, that once he got home, he was able to write the book that he did with the old breed. And luckily, same thing with Lecky. Obviously, he didn't write anything down. He was already a journalist and an author and had a steel trap memory anyhow. And both those guys used that as a way to find closure. Obviously, Lecky went on to write multiple books. But the question I had for you, and Jeff, I'll shut up here in a second and you can ask a few questions. Did Dick Winters carry on that habit or the desire for journal writing into his older years? Did you guys come across any paperwork maybe where he made diary entries about how he was dealing with this newfound fame of being in Hollywood? Or did that kind of go the wayside as technology increased?
Yeah, some of his later correspondence in the 1990s and the 2000s certainly hint at those pressures of celebrity that were placed on him in his final years. And, you know, he in the final years of his life, you know, he had to unlist his address in the phone book. He got a post office box. And the requests for autographs, you know, fan mail and whatnot, it became so overwhelming that eventually he had to quit responding to all of them, because, you know, being the gentleman that he was early on, you know, he always tried to write back to people. But in those last few years, it just became so overwhelming that he couldn't keep up. And there are other bits of correspondence later on as well, you know, with the likes of Ronald Spears, who wanted to have nothing to do with Band of Brothers for the most part, welcomed his privacy, cherished his privacy is a better way to put it, and, you know, wanted to keep to himself. And, you know, it's so revealing, because in the early 90s, with the release of the book Band of Brothers, Winters really tried to reconnect with Spears and bring him back in the fold, because Spears went to one reunion, I believe it was in 1947, and then no one in Easy Company ever saw him again until 2001.
Wow.
When they had that rather iconic reunion at Utah Beach, when they showed portions of the miniseries. So, on and off, Winters and Spears stayed in touch, but they went, you know, essentially 60 years without seeing each other, and they reunited on Utah Beach in June of 2001. And so there's a lot of rabbit holes we could go down in regard to how all of these guys coped with their sudden celebrity in their final years. And that story, that relationship between Spears and Winters, is just one of them.
You got any follow-up questions for him, Jeff?
Yeah, I guess two questions, and one you may have already answered and I missed, but back to Dieta, the Wave, you know, when you mentioned kind of using her as almost a release of things you can't tell your mom, I'm assuming because of that, there was no romantic connection between the two.
That is something that I'm a bit uncertain about, because, you know, there is obvious affection in the letters, but, you know, later on, Winters insisted that their relationship was entirely platonic. That there was no kind of lustful attachment or anything like that. I think the best way to describe it is that he almost saw her like a sister figure. A loved one, someone who was very close, but was more along the lines of a very good friend that he could confide in and could serve as a sounding board. Dieta herself may have had other intentions in the long run. But you know, one of the really kind of sad elements of some of the letters from later in the war is you really get the sense that Winters didn't want to form any more emotional attachments with anybody because he didn't think he was going to make it. And if he did once have some sort of romantic sentiment toward her, I think he severed that because he did not want her to be hurt if he was not to make it.
Yeah, I get the sense, you know, that if it's the girl you love, you're not going to tell her what he probably told her. You know, he's going to want to protect her like the mother figure, you know, but that was just, that's why that kind of became my assumption. It was maybe more like, hey, look what I did. You should be proud of your boy. But if he's really going into some detail as, like you said, more of a release, then you're probably exactly right. Who knows what her thoughts were.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't think you probably tell the girl you love probably as much as he told her. And that's just my assumption I haven't seen these letters, of course, but, my other question, I'm hesitant I'm trying to word it properly because I don't want to take anything away from Winters, of course, but I guess maybe I just assumed the amount of record keeping that he had I don't know. I guess I think back to my time in the military. That's what you expect from your company commanders in any situation. I mean, if you're in the bottom of a foxhole or, you know, back at the talk in the AC playing Halo, your company commander's taking care of stuff. And so I find it interesting. I'm curious because I can tell you that the XO of my unit kept over a terabyte worth of information on what we did in Iraq. And that's not our company. That was our executive officer. And I know he went on to do much bigger and better and greater things. You know, he was a West Pointer and just an unbelievable officer. So I expected that from him. So I'm just kind of curious as to, is that kind of a uniqueness to Winters in those circumstances? Because we know they weren't very easy circumstances to be keeping up with the files that he had to have kept up with. Does it lend more to his memory with the stuff that he put together afterwards, especially when you mentioned the bulge, trying to go back in time and remember some of these things? So I'm kind of curious how many other, you know, commanders were in his position and some of these really hard fights that went on for months. What came out of it? What did those company commanders keep track of? What was actually documented that should have been and maybe lost to time. Maybe it was just lost to history, lost to weather, whatever it was. So I'm curious. Like, maybe it's not really a question, but I don't know if that's a uniqueness to Winters, but more maybe a little bit of dumb luck that it survived and probably credit to him not only to be an officer and a commander like that, but to actually have it to where it's sustainable information for people like you.
Now, hold on real quick, Jared. There's a lot to unpack there. I got to do some traffic copping here. We're getting a 2-minute countdown from Zoom because we're on Zoom free. So if you have a little bit of time, I'm going to kill this meeting and we'll restart it and we'll do maybe another 20 minutes if you have the time.
Sure.
Okay, you guys watching on YouTube and over on Facebook, I do apologize. Hold tight. We'll be back momentarily.
It's one of the most celebrated feats of World War II. On June 6, 1944, more than 160,000 troops stormed the beaches of Normandy during the D-Day invasion. Less known is that an unlikely snack helped power the Allies before, during, and after the historic mission. In 1937, the United States Army approached a food titan about creating a specially designed snack for its emergency rations. According to the food titan's chief chemist, Sam Hinkle, the United States government had just 4 simple requests about their new emergency snack. They had to weigh less than 4 ounces, be high in energy, withstand high temperature, and taste a little bit better than a boiled potato. The Army didn't want the snack to be so tasty that its soldiers would eat it in a non-emergency situation. The final product was called D-Ration Bars, a blend of chocolate, sugar, cocoa butter, skim milk powder, and oat flour. The viscous mixture provided too thick to move through the normal manufacturing setup at the plant, so initially each bar had to be packed into its 4-ounce mold by hand. As for taste, most who tried it said they would rather have eaten the boiled potato. The combination of fat and oat flour made the bar a dense brick, and the sugar did little to mask the overwhelmingly bitter taste. And since it was designed to withstand high temperature, the bar was nearly impossible to bite into, so most soldiers who ate it had to slice off slivers with their knife before chewing it. Despite the U.S. Army's best efforts to stop men from doing so, some of the D-ration bars ended up in the trash. Later on in the war, the Food Titan introduced a new version, known as the Tropical Bar, specifically designed for the extreme temperatures of the Pacific Theater. By the end of the war, the company had produced more than 3 billion ration bars. The bar was hardly the only sweet in D-Day rations. Sugar was an easy way to pep up troops, and the quick burst of energy it provided made a welcome addition to kit bags. Along with the D-rations, troops received 3 days' worth of K-rations. These were designed more as meal replacements and not sustenance snacks like D-rations, and came complete with coffee, canned meats, processed cheese, and tons of sugar. At various points throughout the war, men could find powdered orange or lemon drinks, caramel, chewing gum, and, of course, more chocolate. The D-ration bars, produced by the Food Titan known by the name of the Hershey's Chocolate Company, wasn't the only contribution to the war effort made by Hershey. Hershey also produced parts for the naval anti-aircraft guns. And Hershey wasn't the only Food Titan of the era to join the nationwide effort to support American troops. Heinz created a self-heating can that could be lit with cigarettes. And Kellogg supplied decay rations for the soldiers' breakfast.
Welcome back, everybody. Thank you all for hanging out for the part two of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with our co-host, Jeff Copsetta, and our friend Jared, who is returned. Jeff wasn't here for the beginning. He actually, Jared here, is probably taking the title for the most returned guest. He's been on the podcast, I think it's your third or fourth time. But for those who didn't join us for the first half, Jared's new book, along with his co-author Eric Dorr, is Hang Tough, The World War II Letters and Artifacts of Major Dick Winters. And Jeff asked him a question. We all remember in the series Band of Brothers, after I think it was the Dyke episode, when Dick Winters is writing up the after action report, and his friend came in and said, "Dick, you're not writing a novel. Just put the dates, the time, the important stuff." But as we were talking about, Dick Winters didn't do that. He filled in as much information that he could. And because of his after-action reports and his letters home and all his thorough documentation, that's how we got to know Easy Company and the Band of Brothers as well as we did.
Yeah. And to Jeff's question, I think it's a very fair one. You know, there were thousands upon thousands of company commanders and battalion commanders who were indeed writing novels, quote unquote, in the thickness of their reports and whatnot. But I think what makes Winters unique in the long run is that he added additional layers to those official reports and documents over time. You know, for a lot of officers, when they got home, they put the war behind them. Their after action reports were put in the National Archives, and the vast majority of those have been unread by the masses ever since. But Winters kept in touch with his guys, and he added this very rich human perspective on top of those official records, where he repetitively collected the reminiscences of the men who went through the same actions that he did. And of course, the strength of Band of Brothers is not, you know, in talking about the tactics or, you know, anything like that, but it's a story of people, and it's a story of camaraderie. And that's what Dick Winters truly excelled at collecting and recording. I think that's the best way I can answer that.
Yeah, absolutely. We're so lucky. We, of course, this generation, to have somebody from his generation to record what he did. And, you know, that a lot of times I have found in my short experiences in the military and the civilian world that maybe not the best leader gets promoted. It's usually the best administrator. That's a lesson I think all of us have probably learned over time. And I'm definitely not one of those administrators, I'll be the first to admit. But it's been interesting for me to see and meet. You know, I've met a lot of really incredible veterans, not just from the Second World War, but from previous wars and the current war. You know, and I've had the opportunity to work with some very incredible people. And that's one thing that they had in common, was that they were just darn good administrators. So we're lucky to have people like that, like Winters, and like Don mentioned, you know, people like Sledge. Sledge was just a great administrator. He you know, if he didn't think about, if he didn't write that stuff down in that Bible, or if that Bible came up destroyed, missing, or stolen, yeah, it'd be lost forever, probably. We don't know. But Lecky, maybe he had that type of journalistic aspect where he was probably kind of registering and cataloging things mentally to prepare for later on. We're lucky that men like Winters did what he did. And I'll be honest, my office in both of my places that I've been working have his 10 top 10 leadership qualities, you know, laminated, hanging behind my desk. Naturally, number 10 was hanged up. But the one that strikes me the most, I don't remember what number it was, but it was not worry about who gets the credit. Mm-hmm. You just do your job. I don't know anybody that's really good at that one.
Yeah, right.
Everybody likes a pat on the back. But that is probably, to me, I think that stands out as one of the best qualities in leadership. You just do your job. And whether he, you know, he became famous like he did, but he, even if he didn't, I think to him, it probably wouldn't have mattered one way or the other.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. The most important thing to him were his men. And that bond that they shared to the very end. And of course, we only have two veterans of Easy Company left right now as we speak. But he cherished that more than anything. And this correspondence allowed him to keep that alive. You know, that World War II, for all of the pain that it put him through at moments, you know, it was the pinnacle of his life. And he realized from an early point on that nothing else that he was going to do in his life was going to be as important as what he did in 1944 and 1945. And so to reach your peak when you're only, you know, like 25 years of age, you know, I think that certainly alludes to why so many of these men wanted to stay connected to.
Absolutely. That reminds me of two letters that I wrote from overseas. One began with, "It was the best of times and it was the worst of times." And another was, "I feel like the president of the United States the day after he's no longer president. He'll never top it. No matter what you do the rest of your life, you'll never top it."
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think these are universal truths that are applicable to any time period. You know, and I'm sure Civil War soldiers and Continental soldiers felt the same way. I think it's, you know, a universal emotional trait of people who have experienced combat together.
Jared, on one of your past appearances on the show, we talked about how you guys over at the Furious Fourth Living History Association, how you guys spend time researching and digging through archives to better and to create a better impression, a better display for when educating the public. And obviously you have spent a lot of time researching a lot of different things in the archives, obviously with your different books. You have the Altoona, the Gettysburg National Military Park, and Dispatches of D-Day. When it came to putting together this book, was there a moment where you had to say, okay, this is crazy. I'm seeing handwriting, not only of Dick, you know, it's one thing to go through the National Archives and just read text and writing from people you really know nothing about. But here you are looking at not only Dick Winters, but maybe Spears' handwriting. You're seeing conversations back and forth between people that you've already read books on, you've known, you've seen on TV. You maybe have met one or two of them in an event somewhere. It's almost like reading the transcripts or the lyrics or the music sheets of your favorite bands, was there a part of you that said, okay, stop fanboying out, we got a job to do here? Or did that aspect make it more desirable, or like, I can't wait to get up and do this again tomorrow? Did it take away some of the monotony of digging through the paperwork with that being the case?
With each letter came, I think, fresh interpretations and surprises, you know, as I was going along. And, you know, as the old saying goes, and you walk in somebody else's shoes, you know, you can see the world through a whole other lens of perspective. And certainly that was the case with me as I was researching Dick Winters. I think as I was researching, you know, when I started off, when I thought of Dick Winters, I had the tendency to think of Damian Lewis, the yep. actor who played him. And I suspect that's true of a lot of historical characters who have been portrayed in film. Mm-hmm. We think of the actors who play them and their personification of that individual. But by the time I was done researching Dick Winters and helping to write this book, I no longer thought of Damian Lewis. I thought of Dick Winters as who he truly was. And I would say that was the greatest transition that I made as a historian as I was putting all of these puzzle pieces together. But to your earlier point, I did have to pinch myself at times that I was getting to see this stuff. Because I first saw Band of Brothers when I was in high school. You know, high school friends and I would talk about it, you know, around the lunch table. And like, never in a million years could like 16-year-old me have envisioned that I would have been like handling, you know, some mm-hmm. of these documents and putting this story to paper. And when considering that, it was also a little bit frightening at times.
Yeah, it'd be like, you know, a Beatles fan being asked to write the, you know, the in-depth knowledge of Apple of Apple Records. And having access to all these music sheets and all the stuff that no one has seen.
Yeah, I think that's a great analogy, because, you know, he's so widely respected a figure. You know, I was afraid I was going to like find something about him that was like going to shatter my image of him, or, you know, kind of like tear down the Marble Man, or, you know, something like that. But luckily, nothing like that happened. He really was the sort of persona that is portrayed in the film. You know, he was a stalwart leader. He cared about his men. He had a strong degree of humility. That humility did not prevent him from speaking about his experiences or writing about them or wanting to promote them. And I don't think, you know, him writing his book or being a cheerleader of Easy Company had anything to do with his ego. It was about his desire to make sure that his men got their due in the historical record. And of course, he achieved that by leaps and bounds. And, you know, he just happened to be at the right place at the right moment. And he met the right person in the form of Stephen Ambrose, who, you know, shared that story with the world then.
Just a little maybe fishing bait to get people to go out and buy the book, other than all the great things we've been talking about. But did you guys come across any photos that may have been previously unpublished? Maybe something that wasn't quite super, wow, let's put this in, you know, other forms, but maybe fit perfectly with the book you guys are putting out?
Yeah, in fact, I would say a majority of the photos in our book have never been published before. Nice. There are photos of him at Camp Croft, photos of him in training. There's a great photo, I believe, I can't remember if it's at Camp Croft or not, I'd have to look it up, but there's a great photo of him sunbathing and he's like doing this on the grass in front of the barracks. And, you know, the guy was just built like a brick house.
Yeah,
I mean, he looked like Superman. And, you know, Damian Lewis is a great actor. He was nowhere near like the muscle tone that Dick Winters like actually was. And, you know, so there's a lot of candid photos like that. There are photos that he and Dieta shared amongst each other. You know, she came to visit his family in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And there's some photos of her like little winter field trip that she made. And so, you know, there's a lot of, you know, there's nothing overly dramatic or something that offers a huge revelation, but you know, just life as it was for these people. And I sometimes I think those can be